So actually, I've not been working on this topic for like 6 years or 7 years. I've been busy with other things like the finite generic canonical ring. But since this workshop is about this topic, so I took some of the old stuff and I'm going to tell you what I didn't finish, this new approach. So first of all, I'm going to look at only a very special kind, it's hyperbolic, sometimes called Bode hyperbolic, if there exists no non-conceptual of a map from C to X. Okay. So I will start out with this question, which I did maybe 8 years ago or something, and look at this question of hyperbolicity. That's just an excuse. And so I will look at the fundamental techniques of Bloch and Clemens. And then what actually I want to say is how to branch into other things. I actually at first thought that I would keep this to myself and then develop things, but then I know that time is not on my side, so I want to tell you what is there. So first, discuss the hyperbolicity of moduli space. And then something else that's extremely interesting actually has been in my mind since the early 80s is the use of wild automorphism of the complex number field. Okay. So so first, let's start with the fundamental techniques of hyperbolicity. There are two people which I think made really fundamental contributions other than the classical work of Nevelina, Arfors, Weil, and so forth, okay, Cartan, etc. Okay, so Bloch, I think, is the first one who really got a lot of mileage out of jet differentials. So you take a jet differential, which means that locally it's just a polynomial in the high-order differentials of the coordinate functions, local coordinate functions. So the space of all k jets involves k derivatives, and sometimes you put a weight onto it. Because they are weighted differently. Okay. And the important thing is now usually referred to as Schwarz lemma. When you have a compact manifold. The reason why it's called Schwarz lemma is because there's a map from a disk to itself, and the comparison of the matrix when you have different curvatures, and when one is zero, then the map actually is constant. So that's actually the reason why it's Schwarz lemma. And in this case, if you take a compact complex manifold and holomorphic jet differential on X, manage on an ample divisor, then the pullback would be identically zero. And I think it should be Bloch's theorem. And then the application, of course, also came from Bloch, that if you take hyperbolicity problems, you take a map, then you pull back at zero, and then you find enough independent ones. So that is holomorphic. So let me say something about Bloch's idea to prove the Schwarz lemma. The reason why I want to point it out is that a little bit later, when we look at the moduli space, this will be an initial step or a simpler step of what is needed for moduli space. So his idea is first to express the jet differential in terms of the law of global Meromori functions. Of course, global Meromori functions are only local coordinates, and so when the coordinate functions are being used, they are being differentiated. So you have the logarithmic derivative lemma to take care of the growth rate of the average of log plus of the absolute value. And then since it vanishes on an ample, so you could look at the counting function and then pull back. And the first one is a log order, and the counting function there is of the same order as the for most devices as the characteristic function. So therefore you get a contradiction. if it's not identically zero. So that was in Brock's paper. Of course, that's not the way he wrote it. He wrote it more in words. So let me, for those who like to see some details, so let me reproduce Brock's thing in notation. So this is the characteristic function, and then the Poulbert allocator form is the characteristic function. Okay, and the main thing is about logarithmic real dilemma. So if you take df, even f is meromorphic, log plus, then the order is log order of growth. Okay. So that's obtained by taking the Poisson-Jensen formula and differentiating. So that's an elementary thing. So here is the essential thing of Brock's. So this thing doesn't function. No, never mind. So so here you have the meromorphic function giving you the local coordinates. And then the absolute value is bounded by V of that. So when you take log plus, then you would get the logarithmic derivative. And so if you take the original holomorphic jet differential, of course the coefficients are bounded. And so you just put it as a local bound, and then differentiation of the log of the meromorphic function, local coordinates, would give you the log order. On the other hand, for the counting function, you have the domination like this. So you actually would get a contradiction because the jet differential vanishes on the m-pole. So you have a domination on the one hand and the upper limit, upper bound of the log derivative on the other. So unless you get something identically zero, otherwise that's how you get the Schwarz lemma. Of course, that is the essential thing. And the Schwarz lemma actually deals only with the case of a section. And for the moduli space question, you have to get the vanishing not for sections, but for cohomology classes. So again, you use DD bar and so forth, and I will tell you what remains to be worked out. So it has never been worked out because it's a bit more complicated. Because when you have a transcendental curve, when you do integration by part, you have the boundary term and usually integration twice. But when you have a cohomology class, and also you want to do that, and that is a bit more complicated. So Brock's construction of jet differential, I want to point this out also, is a precursor of Kodaira's method of writing a big line bundle as a sum of an effective Q device and an ample Q line bundle. And that is how you get the vanishing on ample. So Brock uses the abundance of the jet differentials, abundance in the sense that there are many of them, of differential coordinates of the universal cover beam variety. In his case, he was looking at a surface in a three-dimensional beam variety. So you have to differentiate the coordinates of the universal cover, and then you retrick it to the surface. Then you get a lot of those things. And the main thing is that you can get so many that you can squeeze out some positive things. So you just vanish on ample argument, okay? Which is the same as Kodaira's, which Kodaira used later. Okay? And this abundance he observed comes from a generic finite fiber property of the map. Is a forgetful map from a total space of jet differentials by forgetting the base point of the jet differential. And then if you don't have this failure, then it means that your surface inside a beam variety, okay, would not be very curved. If it's very curved, when you retrick it, it has a lot of those things. So so then you could conclude that there is a translation invariant in one direction for the surface inside a beam variety. So that's his idea of doing it. So this kind of abundance argument, squeezing out the positive ample line bundle, is essential. So here, let me make it in symbols. So So here you have a holomorphic magnitude of Abelian differential, and then here you have x, which is inside a Abelian variety. So here you take the jet space, and you could take the jet space of a Abelian variety, jet space of x, which is here, and you can get the forgetful map into here. And so the point is that this forgetful map, so actually you forget about the base, but only take the differentials. Then you want to say that this is generically finite fiber. If it is, then he used the fact that you get a look at the meromorphic function field of the space over this. So that's how he counted the abundance. And this is quite surprising because nowadays everybody quoted Green and Griffith using Riemann-Roch and so forth. But of course he did it before Riemann-Roch. So he used this kind of abundance. Riemann-Roch is just simply a matter of solving linear equations to compute a dimension. So here he computed a dimension by using the function field. So you get the function field here because it's finite fiber is over this one here. So that's why you get a an equation. So you get an ample divisor here going to be zero, then you know that there are a lot of these things pulling back would vanish there. So that's how he got this. And if the the finite fiber thing is incorrect, then you get translational invariance because there's some direction. No matter how many time derivative you take, you cannot distinguish them. So they just move along that. So that's Brock's paper. And so I have to say that in the interlude between the paper written in 26 and even now, there are many variations of Brock's techniques, but you cannot get out of that. And here I undertook to interpret the French into English, because the way he wrote it, without symbols actually, most of the time without symbols, it's not difficult to understand, not easy to understand. And I always joke saying that I could get it because my French is so poor I had to read word by word very carefully. So I finally deciphered what he was trying to say. So if you like, there was a translation from French into English at the crucial point. So another thing that I want to tell you about is Clemens' result, because Clemens' result is about deformation, which turns out to be the second fundamental result. So before one can, the idea I look at is that if you want to prove that something is hyperbolic, that means there's no transcendental curve in it that's rational. First, you have to be able to say that there's no algebraic ones in it, so there should be no rational curve or elliptic curve. In an algebra, that was done by Herb Clemens. So his idea is like this. So he said that suppose for generic hypersurface it's not true. So for every hypersurface you would have some rational curve or elliptic curve inside. And you can piece them together if you take the universal family or all hypersurface of high degree. Okay. And then here is the main point. He argues that you could get meromorphic vector fields on a total space that is slanted. That means it's not along a vertical fiber, because high degree you don't have vector fields. But you have slanted ones, because in a horizontal direction it's just a projective space. There are lots of them. So you sort of compromise and get a slanted one, and you compromise by allowing low pole order vertically. Because if you take vector field vertically, you must have high pole order. If you're horizontal, you don't need any, because it's projective space. And you compromise, just slanted it appropriately, favoring the horizontal, then you get meromorphic vector fields with very low meromorphic pole order. And then you could use those to make sure that the normal bundle, the junction formula for the normal bundle of this guy here, of this guy, is more or less positive. And then a junction formula tells you that this cannot be done because it's composed of rational curve, elliptic curves. They are the low genus things. So if the normal bundle is good, then you get a contradiction. So that is his idea. It's a fantastic thing. Lawrence Ion generalized to complete the section, and then Vasseur improved the degree bound in some papers. And my role is a trivial one, so I took the trivial step of transplanting Clemens thing to a transcendental case. So there, instead of the normal bundle, I use the jet differentials and the slanted vector fields to differentiate the jet differentials. So make sure that you have enough of them. And then there's the question of extending the jet differential, the vertical jet differential, the neighboring one, and that's where hyperbolicity comes in. So that was when I was working on this in around 2000 or so. But then at that time I was seduced by to the dark side by this finite generation stuff. And and I never proofread this preprint, even though it's still sitting in my computer. Because at one point I decided to, I guess Noguchi asked me what happened to it. Well, yeah, but the thing is that when I was presenting this is a combinatorics thing. So I decided to change the notation a number of times just to make things more elegant, hopefully. And then it was not consistent, so I had to make the whole thing consistent. Never found time to make this consistent, so different sets of notations. So that's why I think when I'm here, maybe I could get it, because I want to link it up to the other things, too. So until now, Clemens thing is the only thing, only game in town still for this. It's very ingenious thing, so I have great respect for both Bloch and Clemens. And so let me tell you more precisely Clemens. So these are the symbols, and the key step is the generation of the normal bundle with twisting. So this is twisting in the of degree one in a vertical direction. Okay, so here is the just that junction formula. So if you have some slanted vector field or Meromorphic vector field of local order, then the twisting by a local order would make this positive, and the junction formula would give you a contradiction. So here is the slanted vector field. So in the universal family, that's not how the Clemens wrote it. If you look at his paper, he managed to hide it. That's the reason why people didn't use it for a long, long time. So here you have the universal family. So the coefficients would be the parameters for moduli. And then if you have a vector field, the main thing is that this is the thing. So if you differentiate it to alpha, you would lower this, you look at the z, and you look at the beta, you have that. And then if you multiply by the z, it just compensates for it. Okay. So if you take homogeneous polynomial, it's just a very simple thing. Okay. So then you could get the vector field that would be horizontal and so forth. Okay. So that is the main argument. And now, so is the low pole order. So here, when you look at the hyperbolic geometry of transcendental curves, this is my trivial contribution, you would take the global generation of twisted Q jets. So if you get vector fields to differentiate them, and you want to use lead derivatives to help you differentiate, and since your vector field has meromorphic pole order, when you differentiate, you add some meromorphic pole order to it. But if your degree is very high, you can afford it, so it doesn't really matter that much. Okay. So the difficulty here is the following. So when you differentiate the jet differential, the jet differential has to be defined over the total space, because your vector field is slanted. You cannot just differentiate over one. So you have to do it on the whole family. But in the whole family, then there's the trouble, because it's not easy to produce a holomorphic jet differential over the total space. For example, just the case of plane curves like this. Everybody knows it's a classical way of producing holomorphic one forms for Riemann surface. But if you want to produce it over the total space, your parameter alpha, you have this term that's giving you trouble. Okay, so you cannot get holomeric jet differential on the total space. It would be hard. So then one observes that you just use vertical jets. That means you don't really want to get the jets on the total space, but only the vertical parts okay. So the vertical jets would be tangential to it like this. Okay. So then the argument is, how do you get the vertical jets? Because usually people use Riemann-Roch to do this kind of thing. But Riemann-Roch is simply linear algebra, because historically it comes from a Riemann surface. So if you assign a number of principal parts at points on the Riemann surface, the classical question is to find a Meromori function with assigned principal parts. And then the obstruction would be the sum of residue being zero. So if you multiply by a holomorphic form or even a Meromori form, and you integrate, it has to be zero. And so it's a matter of linear algebra to count how many are there. And then you have the duality, because the residue has to be zero multiplied by Meromorphic field. And high dimensional Riemann-Roch is simply just slicing it and do it. So you get the principal part on the hypersurface and so forth, the same kind of thing. So the main thing is just linear algebra. So if you want to do it, you may as well do it in linear algebra, which would give you a sharper result. So how do you handle the linear algebra? So the main thing is that you just imitate what happens to the holomorphic one forms. So you have a high degree polynomial defining your hypersurface. So if you differentiate this one time, then you get a relation of the differential of the coordinates, and you divide and so forth, implicit differentiation. Then you take care of the poles. Actually, you get vanishing order infinity. And when you have a higher order derivative, you do the same thing. You just differentiate more and more times, and you have one more variable. So when you differentiate many times, you have more and more variables, but they are linked by this hypersurface. But hypersurface is high degree. So if you take polynomial low degree in the differentials, then we check it's still non-zero, because your hypersurface is high degree. You cannot just cancel them. And then you just do the counting, so it's like Siegel Lemma kind of counting, and depends on how good your combinatorics is, that you could count it and get the existence. So that is how it's done. And I did the rather crude job of doing it, and allow exponential, blah blah, and so forth. Okay. So, and then another idea, if you insist on using Riemann-Roch, then the reason why it works is because you have to look at the higher cohomology classes. But if you are in projective space, you differentiate the one forms, then you have a pole order that's quite bounded. Maybe D 1 over W minus 1 over W squared and so forth. So when you take the jet differentials, the jet differentials have lower bound on negativity. And so when you raise the degree, you can get it. And then that is reflected in the linear algebra also. The two things are the same, essentially. And then another thing is you have to get number of independent holomorphic jet differentials. So you take a bundle space, and you know that you don't have surjectivity when you restrict the bundle, but then except for some proper subvariety, this can be done. So the generic hypersurface would be constrained by the direct image, whether the direct image is locally free or not. Okay, direct image locally free, you can extend to the neighborhood, and the jet differential could be differentiated in the sense of Lie algebra to get independent ones. Okay. And so that essentially is the story. And let me just... So if you have enough differentiation, then you could make sure that you could eliminate the actual differentials of the coordinates and get a subvariety. Okay. You have to worry what happens after you get the sobriety. The degree there also is bound that you could just repeat this kind of combinatorics thing number of times. You're just getting rather involved unless you are generous with your estimates of the degree. And also, this thing I want to mention too, that if you just want degeneracy in the weaker sense, that means that there's a proper sobriety to contain an image, doesn't have to be generic. This is sort of abundance argument too about the big line bundle, essentially. But you have to do it successively. That means if you have enough section, then at least you have one point that you could get it. Okay, that's this old argument about bigness and so forth. That's why I mentioned it in Brock's case. So you could get rid of generic if you just want this weaker thing. Because in neighboring ones is good, you take the limit. And then you could only guarantee that at one point it is the case. Now here begins something I want to tell you about, which also is old from about 2000, but I never told people, so it's just, in a way can consider that as new. Okay. So it's the question of hyperbolic moduli space. So people would ask for examples of hyperbolic hypersurfaces. And usually examples are obtained by Borel's lemma, you know, sum of the powers of something equal to zero, okay, high powers. Or if you like, you can call this ABC conjecture kind of thing. You have the high power. And or in general, you could do it with high degree and very few number of terms, so call it few normals or something. Then you could get the examples. And of course, that's the question of combinatorics, how good you are, and you can lower the degree and how many examples and so forth you can get. Okay. But what I want to point out actually is the important class of hyperbolic manifolds, which occur naturally, not from these combinatorics, but naturally is a moduli space. Okay. Now, in the last 10 years or so, there has been a lot of activities in algebraic geometry in that area. Okay. So I have the habit of trying to borrow things from algebraic geometry. That's why I look at Clemens' thing and just trivially transplant it. So you want to do the same thing here too. Look at algebraic geometry, see what they've got here in this case. So look at the moduli space of compact-complex manifold with ample canonical line bundle, okay, in the sense of algebraic geometry. So Migliorini started this game. So we want to say that you have a smooth family. If the genus, if you have general type and the base has low genus, either the family is a product, is isotrivial, or you have singularities. So that was his idea. And then Corvus and did it more. And final thing was done by Eckhart Fivek and Kang Zhuo. A very complicated argument here. And so I want to tell you what is involved analytically and what should be done here. So first, look at the main point of all these techniques, Brock techniques of the Schwarz lemma and jet differentials. What does it mean? It means that you are actually looking at the base manifold, and then you have a jet differential, the vector bundle of jet differential on top of it. Okay, and then when you try to pull it back to see the change of base from the algebraic to the transcendental, you get a contradiction because your bundle has certain metric properties. Namely, you have the jet metric that has negativity. So you pull back, you have trouble. Okay. And now you try to do this sort of thing for a more general family so that the fiber is no longer this vector space of the metric, but some more general family. And that is the reason for this moduli space situation. So the family would be composed of fibers that are compact complex manifolds with ample canonical I bundle, and that takes the place of the vector space with the metric. Now, of course, when you have a compact complex manifold with ample canonical I bundle, automatically there's some metric. There's a Kähler-Einstein metric and the kind of metric. So there's also some metric coming in. And in general, I think people consider the canonical line bundle on a total space. That actually is a very important thing. I think I remember in the mid-90s, Tsuji already looked at this in the sense of Kobayashi volume form. You see, when you have this family and look at the pluricanonical sections, and you want to get a metric on the canonical line bundle, you have a Bergmann metric. I think Tsuji introduced this iterative Bergmann metric on it, and also introduced the Kobayashi volume. And then the question is whether you have pluriharmonicity on a total space. The direct image has been done a lot, but the total space actually seems to be the key. And so here, you want to ask about hyperbolicity of the moduli space. Okay. Now, you want to say that it comes from the curvature property. So you remember the Bloch's argument. You pull it back. Essentially, you're using dd bar of a certain sign and integrated by part twice and so forth. You have this vanishing, and usually it's done by getting a metric on the ample line bundle and taking the curvature for the ample line bundle and pull it back and compute a characteristic function from it. Okay, and that forces things to vanish. And so the argument of Bloch also comes from curvature argument. And so you want to do the same thing, saying that in this case of a family, you have it. So let me tell you in the algebraic setting what is going on. And what is lacking is the generalization of Schwarz lemma to this case, which I believe that anybody with some patient sitting down probably could come up with something. Okay. So here is the context. So let me explain things in the simplest possible case. You have a holomorphic family of compact complex manifold over regular curve C. Assume that the complex dimension of the total space is x, so the fiber has complex dimension n minus 1. Okay. And the game is to see how the curvature on the fiber affects the curvature on the base after you take the right image. So here is the junction formula or whatever you call it. You take the Q forms on the total space and we check it to the to the fiber. Then if it's zero, then it must come from downstairs. Okay, so this is the bundle along the fiber. So if we check along the fiber zero, then it must one factor must come from downstairs. Okay, so that's clear. So we are going to investigate what happens to the dd bar or the curvature, the relation between the total space and the base. So you take any holomorphic line bundle L over X, then you have this connecting homomorphism. I forgot this thing. Okay, so now I really want it. So here. Here you have the sort of exact sequence, and here is the connecting homomorphism. Okay. After you tensor with L, the important thing of this connecting homomorphism is that it is the same as multiplication by the global Kodaira-Spencer class. So Kodaira-Spencer class is H1 with coefficient in the tangent bundle. And because you have deformation everywhere, so you have a global section. And here you have the canonical line bundle, because you have to differentiate before you get the class. So the Kodaira-Spencer class is the differential of the family, so to speak. Okay. So that is the map of contracting with this element. That's why HP minus 1 becomes HP, and this is reduced by 1 because of the tangent space. Okay. And then you have the canonical class. Okay. And so that's what's happening here. So the whole theory is try to rule out the following, that the fiber canonical line bundle is positive, and the base has low genus, actually non-positive. Okay. And you want to rule this out. Okay. And you rule this out by solving Debye equation, by the maximum principle, essentially. Debye, the vanishing theorem. The vanishing theorem actually is the maximum principle. You take the Laplacian and so forth, you know, curvature is the maximum principle, secondary test. And the Bloch's proof of the Schwarz lemma also is secondary test, except that here we have to do it in filtration. We'll do it step by step quite a number of times. That is the main difference. So here it is. Okay. So this connecting homomorphism, let me again see this. Okay. This connecting homomorphism here increases H by 1 and decreases by 1, and then you have to add the canonical line bundle of the base. Okay. So that's what's happening here. And so as you keep on doing this, you can get vanishing theorems because of the vanishing theorem of Nakano, Akizuki Nakano. So it's the HP and Q, and this line bundle is a positivity. So you have this vanishing. So you keep on doing it, you can raise it. That means you have, in a filtration manner, you have the vanishing theorems all the time from the curvature. And you're putting together, you finally get this from one to the other. And you want to look at the extreme situation. So the extreme situation would be from H1 to Hn. But here, you have a vanishing theorem. You would get the H1 being 0. But the Hn here is actually the dual of the section and is non-zero. So you get a contradiction. That's how you get a contradiction with this kind of thing, that the fiber will have canonical line bundle positive, but the base, the genus low, for example, the canonical line bundle is non-positive. And this you get by looking at the adjunction, which the connecting homomorphism, which transfers the curvature from the fiber to the base via the total space. And so this way, you can get surjectivity and so forth, and then a contradiction. Now, I want to emphasize this is the algebraic geometric situation, because we are doing integration by parts to get the vanishing theorem. The vanishing theorem is just take the Laplacian and integration by parts, or the maximum principle. But you want to get a transcendental curve, you have the boundary term to worry about. And this has not been carried out. So the boundary term is, of course, the proximity term and so forth. You have to handle it by integration by parts twice. Okay. So in Bloch's case, this was done. Okay. That's the logarithmic derivative lemma that helps you do it. Okay. And you want to do it here the same way, but you have to do it in a filter manner each step. You have to do it. Of course, you can put them all together in this hypercohomology kind of thing, this zigzag in a double compact zigzag thing with the hypercohomology. You can do it in one single step as well. But somewhere you have to do this estimate, which is, I think, is completely analogous to, well, hopefully, complete. I never done it, by the way. I was thinking that sometime I have time to do it, but time is running short. And at some point, the logarithmic derivative lemma has to be used in this case. Okay. And then you say why and how. Again, you just follow Bloch. You have the jet differentials. These are the omega p. Okay. And you have used local coordinates that come from log of a Meromorphic function. The same technique. So when you want to get the vanishing theorems of Kodaira, Kizuki, Nakano, and so forth, when you get estimates and you get maximum principle and so forth, you remember that you always use as local coordinates log on the Meromorphic function. And then the logarithmic derivative lemma. And I think that will do the job. Okay. Now, before those algebraic people came along as an analyst, I never tried this hypercohomology. But I did try to transfer it by the brute force computation of the curvature. I look at the Kähler-Einstein manifold negative first term class and actually compute a Wey-Peterson metric. And it was a long computation, but I end up with one term which I couldn't quite control, is the Kodaira-Spencer class wedged with itself. And I couldn't get hold of that. So I couldn't prove this hyperbolicity this way. Now, the surprising thing is that what I presented a moment ago depends on the wedging of the Kodaira-Spencer class. You remember we have this connecting homomorphism. Connecting homomorphism actually is multiplication by the Kodaira-Spencer class. And you keep on multiplying it. And so you actually want this thing multiplied as many times as the dimension of the fiber. Because we get all the way from the top degree to one in the cohomology. And so, of course, you get hyperbolicity only if the family is not trivial. If family is trivial, clearly you don't have hyperbolicity. Whether it's trivial or not depends on the Kodaira-Spencer class. And the Kodaira-Spencer class represents deformation in all possible directions because you are in n-dimensional state. In order to make sure that you cannot cheat by deforming only in one direction, you are required to wedge it to the top degree. And that is why the connecting homomorphism has to do all the way down. And what started out as the culprit now suddenly turns the hero. It helps you get the hyperbolicity. And then you say, why is that the case? Because the hyperbolicity there comes from variational hot structure. You have this flat Betti groups on the fiber, it's completely flat. But the analytic cohomology classes by the hot filtration are sub-bundles inside. And they carry negative curvature, unless the second fundamental form is zero. Okay, in that case, there's no deformation. So that is why the Kodaira-Spencer class actually helps you to get this thing hyperbolic, because actually it nails down the negative curvature when it's compared to the flat bundle from the Betti groups, or the Betti vector space. Okay. And so then you have negative curvature and then you are vanishing and so forth. That's the reason why everything works. So when I was trying to compute a Wey-Peterson, I was doing the wrong thing, because there was one background, which is a flat background you want to make use of. And here, I didn't use that flat background. Okay. Now, another topic I want to tell you about, which I think is an important thing, is the wire automorphism of the complex number field. Okay. The Clemens method is a deformation method. You want to have a slanted vector field. You want to move the jet differential from next door to your original thing. And of course, in a movement, you want to take the derivative. Okay, so that's why you get independent ones. So you want to deform. The trouble is that in general, you cannot deform. In the case of a hypersurface, you are okay. You just perturb the coefficients you are deforming because there's no constraint on it. And in the case of complete intersection also, you just deform each one. But in general, you are in trouble. Because if you have some algebraic submanifold of a certain codimension, the number of equations defining it would be more than a codimension in general, and it's not complete intersection. Yeah? So let's say you've codimension 2, you may need 3 equations to take away some branches. Yeah? And so if you just perturb the coefficients of the equations, you end up with codimension 3 because they don't work anymore. So you cannot deform. And then what can you do to deform it? You find some other way to deform. And that is the wild automorphisms of the complex number field. Now, if you have non-complete intersection, and let's say codimension 2 and you have 3 equations, okay, then if you perturb a little bit, you cut down the codimensional 3. And the original one, why do you get codimension 2? Because you want to get common zeros, you take the resultant, something is 0. Okay, so that means they have something in common, some branches in common. So the resultant is 0. Okay, so if you change the coefficients and keep this resultant condition, you are in shape. Okay. How do you keep this resultant condition? The resultant condition is just by algebraic operation. I mean, you form the matrix, take determinant, blah, blah, and so forth. And if you have automorphism of the complex number field and applied automorphism of the coefficients, then all these resultant things would just stay. So you have also the same codimension. Actually, you get another one. And the automorphisms are not homeomorphisms of the complex number field. Okay. Because they are obtained by two things. One is that any automorphism of a subfield can be extended. Another is the algebraic closure of C. And the Zorn's lemma, now this is something people don't like because you have to use Zorn's lemma, and then some people have some logical reservations for using it. So you have chain, usually called a chain, an increasing set, and the union is there, then there's a maximal member. Okay. So if you have an automorphism of a subfield, then you look at the chain of subfields of C for which you have automorphism, and then a union, of course, is okay, and then there's a maximal one, because the algebraically closed, if you have a maximum, you can always add something to it unless it's C. Okay. You make some algebraic extension, and then you have another automorphism. So that's why Zorn's lemma would give you many, many such wild automorphisms. But it is non-trivial to explicitly construct one. So now, how do you actually try to deform? So you take a submanifold in Pn, defined by a finite number of homogeneous equations, or maybe I kept forgetting about this thing. Okay. So you take a number of homogeneous equations and then the finite number of coefficients. So you generate a field and you are manifoldly defined over the field. Okay. So the field in general will be algebraic extension of a purely transcendental extension of the rational number field. Okay. Now, then the Zorn's lemma tells you that automorphisms of K can be extended. Okay. But you may not have automorphisms of K. You always have this Galois group, but then you map K elsewhere. Okay. The Galois group may map K elsewhere. So, but if that's the K, you take the Galois group and take your X and then map it by using this isomorphism of K into C, which may get out of C, but you take the union. So this has the same effect as adding branches so that it can be deformed. But then it's different because this automorphism actually gives you a manifold which is very much like your original one. Now topological is not like your original one because the automorphism of the field of complex numbers is not a homeomorphism. Topological is very different. Okay. But there's something more interesting involved. So you take this thing here, then this union will define over this smaller one because we marry under the Galois group. And now you can use rational functions of these transcendental elements to get a field isomorphism of this guy. Just take some rational functions. And so you can extend it to a wild automorphism of C. And when this is chosen close to the original one, in terms of numbers, then you actually have a deformation. Okay. The Y automorphism doesn't give you homeomorphism, but they are close together. So they actually have a deformation. So then how do you use the techniques of this wild automorphism? So now, of course, you cannot get something from nothing. So suppose you are able to produce some jet differentials, and then your job is to find independent ones. Then you can take the jet differential on X, and then you apply this Gawa group to map it elsewhere, and then you deform, and then you get holomorphic or meromorphic vector fields with low vertical pole order. So again, I said it's never been developed here, but I think this is it is very useful. Okay. Now, there's another interesting aspect when I was looking at it many years ago. While automorphism of the complex number field is not a homeomorphism, but when it comes to computation of the dimension of the space of jet differentials, they are the same. Because these computations are by linear algebra and a defining equation. So it doesn't matter what the underlying topology is. You don't really care. You just keep on using linear algebra and so forth. So the dimension is the same. So you just move one to the other by it. And this is important, that you take the underlying space, you don't have any conclusion, but you look at the dimension of the space of jet differentials or the space of sections of vector bundles, especially look at asymptotic growth rate, they are the same. Okay. And this is quite interesting, because if you take an algebraic manifold, people have already computed these many times. You could use Riemann-Roch exact sequence and so forth and do the computation of jet differentials. You end up with some C1 and C2 and so forth. You use quite a lot of them, and you take asymptotic things. And then you conclude that the C1 to the power n is the same, and C1 n minus, not 1, there's a misprint. This is Cn minus 2, okay. This is Cn minus 2, and the Cn minus 2 will be the same. And then it has the interesting conclusion that if x is the quotient of the ball, or the complex ball, your pi is again quotient of the complex ball, because of the general type statement, because the sections of things are comparable. And also because C1 squared equals 3C2 for a surface, and the corresponding thing for the higher dimensional case. Okay. And now, so when X is the quotient of arithmetic subgroup, or the homomorphism group of the complex N ball, this is a consequence of the very famous theorem of Kajdan. It's a very, very long proof using Magruder's technique and so forth. If X is an algebraic manifold here, it's the compact quotient of bounded symmetric domain, and your Y automorphism, then again is the compact quotient of bounded symmetric domain. Again, the topology, underlying topology is completely changed, but the reason why this thing works from my point of view is that something from the curvature is being preserved because of the dimension of the space of jet differential. Okay. Now, of course, I told you about the quotient of ball, and you asked what happens to the other cases. I haven't had time to look at them. I think Ban Wong here spent some time looking, maybe he can tell you what happens to that case. Actually, this approach is getting something more general than Kajdan, because I had to assume even in the case of Boyd, the arithmetic subgroup. Okay, so these are the papers of Kajdan. And now you ask the question, for this kind of thing, if you apply this wild automorphism, could you preserve certain properties of the manifold? Okay. So for example, Kajdan pointed out the quotient of the bounded symmetric domain. Okay. So here, what can you do to get it? Now, when you look at curvature, of course, because even the topology is not conserved, when you look at curvature, it's completely hopeless. But when you look at the dimension of the space of sections, they are the same. You do algebraic computation, they are the same. And the dimension, the asymptotic rate of the growth of the dimension, is a purely algebraic thing, but it reflects the curvature from Riemann-Roch. So that's why you get some statement about the curvature. Okay. And then precisely how much do you get from the curvature? I mean, a lot of people wrote papers on the formulas, Riemann-Roch and so forth. Then you could apply those formulas to see how much you can get. When I looked at Kashtan's paper, at that time, it was late 70s, early 80s, I was very much interested in something else, strong rigidity and so forth. And actually I was trying to get some case of the Hodge conjecture from it, but never succeeded. So I was looking at the strong rigidity. So then I asked whether you could get something from the strong rigidity. The strong rigidity, of course, tell you something about vanishing theorems, about the Riemann-Roch and so forth. Of course, another thing is that you could slice your manifold with the sections produced algebraically and look at what happens there too. So it's not just the Chern numbers, but the Chern number restricted. So there's a lot of things there. But the question is whether you have enough to guarantee that. Or even the hyperbolicity, which comes from curvature and so forth. And of course, the hyperbolicity is related to the jet differential, the independent jet differentials. The two things are not equivalent. I mean, the independent jet differential would be sufficient to get hyperbolicity, but the other way around is not that clear. So are they very much preserved by this wild automorphism of the complex number field? Okay. This kind of exercise mainly is to produce examples. Because it's hard to produce hyperbolic hypersurfaces. I mean, people came up with so many examples, so many family examples. But you have this Y automorphism essentially is uncountable. And these things is huge. Okay. Of course, people don't like them because they use Swan's lemma, maybe logically not very on very firm ground. Maybe they don't exist. But I think we have been living with Swan's lemma for a long time anyway. So this is a very interesting direction. So I think I'll stop here. The time is up. Thank you for your attention.